Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Black With No Chaser. I'm your host, Tyrus Kennedy, and tonight we are talking about COVID-19. The name of this talk is The Disproportionate Truth, Bearing the Brunt of COVID-19. And, you know, we all know how the history of Black people in this country, you know, with racism, it has a very complex and a very widespread effect on the health and the healthcare of Black people. And COVID-19 has really brought, you know, this to the forefront as much as anything that I can remember. You know, Black folks have been dying at a rate a lot higher than their white counterparts. And, you know, it's just something that we need to get a hold of. For instance, in New York City, Blacks make up about 22% of the population, and they have they represent like 28 to 30% of all deaths. In Chicago, Blacks are 30% of the population and 70% of the deaths. And in Louisiana, Black folks make up 32% of the population and about 70% of all deaths. And, you know, talking about it, it brings up the old adage that I've heard, when white America catches a cold, Black America catches pneumonia. And joining me tonight to talk about this are three fabulously fantastic doctors who are sisters, not just this type of sisters, but actually blood sisters. And I think that's just absolutely wonderful and mind-blowing. So what I'm going to do is just step back, and I'm going to let each one of you introduce yourselves to everybody and, you know, talk about yourself a little bit and give you credentials and all of that. So the floor is yours.
Okay. So I'll start. I am Dr. LaTanya Washington. I am board certified in internal medicine and pediatrics. I live in Memphis, Tennessee. My current job is that I am the physician advisor at a local hospital here. And I've done most of my career as a hospitalist. And basically what that means is I was a doctor working inside of the hospital, taking care of patients in the hospital. But I have done private practice as well. So that's a little bit about me. I'm the oldest, which is why I started first. And then I'll pass it on to Dr. Kimberly.
Did everybody see my eye roll when she said I'm the oldest? Anyway, so I'm the middle. Kim Washington, I am a board certified general surgeon. Was in private practice here in Arlington, Texas. Recently left that practice, and I'm about to start a training program, an additional fellowship training in hepatobiliary surgery, which is liver, pancreas, bile duct surgery in Portland, Oregon. So currently live in Dallas. We'll be moving to the Pacific Northwest in a couple of weeks.
All right, and so I guess I'll be last. I'm the youngest. I'm Jasmine Washington, currently in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm a board certified internal medicine physician, but currently undergoing subspecialty in nephrology, so the study of kidney diseases.
Thank you, Dr. LaTanya, Dr. Kimberly, Dr. Jasmine, for doing this. You know, we here at Black and No Chaser think it's very important to get, you know, not only current information out, but, you know, right information, because there's so much misinformation and just stupid stuff that's being, you know, passed along about COVID-19. So I wanted to start off asking this question, or basically just saying, can you explain exactly what COVID-19 is?
Yeah, I can take that question. So COVID-19 or coronavirus disease 19 is what it's called. So it's a coronavirus infection. And I know when COVID-19 first came out, people were taking photographs of the back of Lysol that says it kills coronavirus. So this is a specific type of coronavirus. You know, coronaviruses have been around forever. Coronaviruses can cause you to have the common cold, but this particular type of coronavirus is called SARS-CoV-2, and that's what causes the COVID-19 disease. So that's what it is in regards to the virus.
And just to piggyback on that, there is a difference between a virus and a bacteria. And I think that there's a lot of misinformation out there about that, because people talk about, well, just give us antibiotics. Well, antibiotics only work on bacteria. So in order to treat a virus, you can't use an antibiotic. It happens a lot when people think that it's some bacterial infection and they give antibiotics, but antibiotics don't work on a virus, period. So just understand, a bacteria is a living organism. It can replicate on its own. It doesn't need your body to do that. It can replicate on your countertops, like salmonella. Whereas a virus needs your body in order to replicate. So it has to use your own cell in order to make more of itself. And so that's the reason why those two things are significantly different. It's much harder to make an antiviral than it is to make an antibiotic for that reason. So just so that you guys have those two things separated in your mind. We're not talking about a bacteria here. We're talking about a virus. And so they're managed a little bit different. They present differently. They're transmitted differently. It's much easier to pass a virus along than it is to pass a bacteria. So just wanted to clarify that as well.
So, Dr. Kimberly, you just mentioned that how it's easily, you know, how it's transmitted differently. We've seen, like, Dr. Fauci and some others talk about how, you know, the 6 feet distance, or, you know, 10 feet, or, you know, the separation between people. Like, how is it transmitted? Is it not just airborne? Can you get it from, you know, I know somebody can cough and you can get it like that, but, you know, again, like I've heard that you can, you know, somebody can hand you a bag of food and you can get it from the wrapper, or you can get it from touching the surface, or you can get it from, you know, somebody breathing on you, sneezing on you. Is there any other ways that you can contract this?
So, interestingly enough, that's a really complex question. I know it seems really simple to say, how do you get it? But it actually is very, very complex. Mainly because we know that you can get it from respiratory secretions, which is, you know, sneezing on someone, coughing on someone. We know you can get it from that. We have to assume you can get it from blood as well. So just because it's got to be in your blood, we have to assume that. There's been no studies about that, but we assume that it can be transmitted if I were to cut myself with something with a needle that you've been stuck with, right? So we assume that. We don't know yet, but we suspect you can get it from stool, which we call fecal oral, meaning people don't wash their hands after they use the bathroom and wipe themselves, and then they cook someone else's food or touch someone else's food and they pass it along. That's how we get things like hepatitis, which is a different virus. So that's another way that we think you can get it. We're not 100% sure about that yet. Obviously, because any kind of fluids that your body makes can carry the virus, then we're pretty sure you can get it from sexual contact. So that's another possible way. So we really can't rule anything out yet with this virus, because we've only really known that it existed for the last 7-ish months here. Now in China, they've known for probably more like 10. But we've only known about it really here for about 7 months. So we haven't been able to check every possible thing. So at this point, I would say definitely be careful about any type of contact. Can you get it from a plastic bag being handed to you at a grocery store? Probably not, but we're not 100% sure. So just it really depends on how many copies of that virus is on that person's hand that's holding that bag that gets passed to you, and if your immune system can manage that number of viruses that you got contact with, if that makes sense. So I wouldn't X anything out as a possibility of how you can catch this virus at this point.
Yeah, and then also to piggyback on what Kim said is when we say respiratory droplets, recognize that you are producing respiratory droplets by talking, by breathing, all of those things. So even if you're in an office setting or outside, anytime you're talking to someone, anytime you're breathing, then there's a risk for those viral particles to be transmitted in the air that we breathe. And then that's one of the main reasons why the recommendations are to wear a mask.
And similarly, that's why I think earlier on in the pandemic, there was discussion similarly to talking about virus particles being transmitted on bags, but on hard surfaces like cardboard boxes or more solid surfaces. That's why it's a really big deal that whenever you get certain types of products and things, make sure that you clean those surfaces because as Kim and Tanya said, we don't know at this point, how readily transmissible the virus is on multiple surfaces. So playing safe is the best at this point.
Now, speaking of playing safe and Dr. Tanya, you mentioned the mask. Before we continue on with this conversation, can you do me a favor and, show people like the proper way to wear their mask? Because, like I was telling you offline, I've seen, people wearing them with the hole cut out, where their nose and their mouth is, which, renders it useless. I've seen it on chins. We've seen it every type of way except the correct way. So can you take a second to, show people what to do?
Yeah, I can. Okay. So, initially, based on the information that we had coming out, they were saying that there wasn't evidence to support the use of masks. But we now know that to not be true. Then also, even in the past, in countries like China that went through like the SARS pandemic and epidemic, they did studies to show that masking does work. So it's important that when you wear the mask that you wear it properly. So I do have one here. One of the most important things is to have a mask, number one. Number two is make sure when you wear your mask that it completely covers your nose and your mouth. I see so many people out and about with a mask on with it like this. That's not useful because, again, remember, I talked about that you can produce these respiratory droplets when you're breathing. So if your nose is out, then those droplets are coming out. So you're at risk. If you have the coronavirus, you're at risk of infecting other people. And if other people have the coronavirus, your nose is out that you can inhale these particles from other people as well. So completely cover your nose and mouth. I know a lot of people, I wear glasses usually. It can cause your glasses to fog up. So, and that just takes some practice to be able to maneuver it so that it doesn't fog your glasses. But you take the mask, you kind of bend it to form a seal. If it's a cloth mask, then just make sure you have a pretty tight seal. Cover your nose and mouth. And then I can put this on my ears. I won't put it all the way on this time. But this is the appropriate way to wear the mask. It's important that you not wear it as a chin strap. Of course, that's not helping at all. And then I've seen people, like I said, the most common thing that I see is people with their noses out. And so that's unhelpful. Really, if you have the nose out in your mask, you may as well not be wearing one. So that's the mask demonstration. Really, initially they were saying that the N95 masks are the ones that were the most protective. That still is true. There has been a shortage of N95 masks. And we use those in the healthcare setting. Just a regular surgical mask or a three-ply mask, that's what this is. I've seen those. I saw some yesterday in Sam's Club. So those are pretty readily available. And then cloth masks, people are making them. You can use some things. I've seen people cut up an old t-shirt and cut slits in the side to be able to have a cloth mask. Bandanas work as well. My concern with the bandanas is that sometimes they're open on the bottom, and so the respiratory droplets can come through there. I also wanted to take a moment to just talk about, I've seen a lot of people out and about And sometimes they'll just wear the face shields, which is that clear guard that covers the face and the eyes. So there is a risk that you can contract the coronavirus infection through the eyes as well. But just recognize that the face shield works only when used in conjunction with the mask. So the mask to cover and not allow the respiratory droplets to get into your nose and mouth as well. So it's important that you have both. If you have to wear only one thing, then please choose to wear the mask and not only the face shield. And I understand that a lot of people have said that it's uncomfortable. I get it. I mean, as physicians, we can all speak to that, you know, particularly Kim, she's a surgeon. She scrubs into 12-hour cases and she wears a mask the entire time. And she's still with us. She didn't die. So I know a lot of people talk about that it causes decreased oxygen and increased carbon dioxide, and that's simply not true.
And just to add to that as well, just because I wear these things all the time, pro tip, you may want to consider, I personally use the masks that have a little sticky area right along the nose when I'm in the OR, just because I do wear glasses frequently. And that avoids any kind of fogging of your glasses. So if you have trouble with that, then what you may want to do in your cloth mask, in your surgical mask, just go to the store and grab a thing of double-sided tape and just put a little strip on there and then form it to your nose and you won't fog up your glasses. So I do that frequently in the OR so I don't have foggy glasses. The other thing is to know, because there's a lot going around on Twitter, particularly from some of the politicians, that that the use of masks really has not been proven to decrease transmission of viruses, of respiratory viruses. And that's just simply not true. Honestly, in the Journal of American Medical Association, recently they published a review of over 100 studies that have shown in the past with SARS, with MERS, in the past couple of decades that mask usage does decrease the transmission of these viruses. So I would say definitely don't listen to the politicians when it comes to scientific things. If you want the information, we can provide that on Facebook. You can read the whole article. It's there. The data is there. And it's clear that using the mask, having a meter apart, which is about 6 feet, and using eye protection definitely does decrease transmission of these viruses. So.
Now, staying with the mask real quick, how often, you know, should people like change out, you know, their mask? You know, I've seen somebody wear the same mask, you know, 3-4 days. It, like, you could tell because it's dirty on the outside and all of that, or if people use bandanas or cloth or whatever, how often should they wash it and you know, change it all out?
So ideally, with cloth masks, you should wash them daily. Also with the other disposable masks, typically they're meant for single use, but I know given the circumstances and how difficult it is to obtain some single use masks. Some people do try to stretch them. I think it's reasonable, again, if it's not soiled on the outside or the part of the mask that faces the environment, that you can use them a couple of days. But beyond that, you may, because you have to take it on and take it off, sometimes you may be putting yourself at a higher risk of being infected by touching the outside surface that would be collecting any particles there. So you want to limit how many times you use those reusable masks before disposing of them or washing them.
So, you know, starting off, I kind of, you know, talked about some of the numbers in different places. And the information that I got, yeah, I got it from the Harvard Business Review, I believe, and some from the CDC from back in May. What are the numbers looking like now from from your experience. I'll start with you, Dr. Tony.
Yeah, so pretty much the numbers are continuing to increase. So the number of cases of COVID-19 are increasing. The number of deaths from COVID-19 are increasing pretty much across the board. I don't think that there has really been any state in the country that has shown that they've had a decrease in the number of cases or death, like a decline in the percentages of cases or deaths since this pandemic started. And then when we look at those numbers as well, we are still seeing the disproportionate effects in communities of color. African Americans, members of the Latino community, we have seen a significant disparity there. I know I looked at the numbers for here in the Memphis area a couple of weeks ago, and I think that Latinos make up about 7% of the population, but they accounted for like 28% of the COVID-related deaths here in the Memphis area. And so it really depends on the population, but for most communities, we are seeing that African-American patients are more severely affected, and Latino Americans are more severely affected than any other people group. And, you know, there are a lot of questions surrounding that, like what causes, like why is that, you know, and those, I mean, there are numerous reasons. You know, anytime you look at any type of illness, Black and brown people always kind of get the short end of the stick. And you know, COVID is no different. Initially, Tyrus, like you said, you know, we were hearing that, oh, Black people can't get coronavirus, and that turned out not to be true. And when you look at other chronic illnesses, pretty much all types of cancers, diabetes, heart disease, strokes, you know, people who are African American or Latino tend to have worse clinical outcomes. And we really didn't expect COVID to be any different. Now, what we do know is that there are certain chronic conditions that make you more likely to have a worse clinical course or have poor outcomes associated with coronavirus, and that is diabetes, that is obesity, that's heart disease. We know that those conditions are very prominent in the African American community and in the Latino community. So we tend to see those things. Oftentimes, many patients may not have those conditions under the best control, which makes them more at risk. But then we have other things that are in the community, or other conditions that we call the social determinants of health, that can also play a part in outcomes with COVID-19. And so one of those things is that, you know, a lot of Black and brown people have forward-facing jobs, have essential jobs. They work in healthcare, they work in the service industry where they have to come into contact with other people. There are also a lot of people who may not have a car where they have to use public transportation that automatically exposes them to other people. There are folks who live in multi-generational households where grandparents, parents, kids and grandkids are all living in the same house. Well, you can imagine if that's the case, then it's difficult to social distance. And if one of those people are, you know, have to work, which most people do, then they're working outside of the house, and they are coming back into the home, which exposes everyone else who's inside the home to the things that were happening outside. So those are all just a few of the reasons why we're seeing a disproportionate effect for African Americans and Latino Americans in this pandemic.
One thing I would like to say to add to that, though, just a recent development is that I know the assumption is that most states, or pretty much all the states, have increasing numbers, but that's not exactly true with New York. And interestingly enough, yesterday was the first day since March 11th that New York had zero deaths from COVID. So they're doing something right in New York, but they had that huge spike on the front end. And then they really locked everything down for quite a long time. And so now they're just sort of slowly reopening things. So we'll be able to see what their process is. But New York is that exception to the rest of the nation, that they have seemed to have flattened their curve. And I say that cautiously, because we talk about that, flattening the curve, and how that became a big mantra in America and worldwide. But we've seen a lot of countries where they felt like they got things under control, and then there would be small outbreaks, and they would need to lock things down again. I don't think we're going to be any different. I think there's going to be waves. It's going to be mountains and valleys of this opening and closing, if we do this the way we should do it, which unfortunately we haven't really been doing it the way we should do it. So that creates some doubt as to whether or not we're going to do that moving forward. So I would say New York is the exception in the nation so far. But time will tell, because we're a year out from having a mass-produced, vaccine, at least. So regardless of what anybody say, we're probably a year out from it.
So I do have a question. Dr. Latanya, you was talking about, like, some of the things that contribute to the racial disparities, that Black people face. And I was reading this book, and it was talking about, like, some of the things that they see in medical school. And one passage I came across, it talked about how Black people as a whole are viewed as, like, our pain tolerance is, so much higher than, everybody else. And, because of that, a lot of doctors and nurses take what we say hurts, and take our pain less seriously. Is that something that you've seen, any of you have seen a lot of and continue to combat? And do you think that may be a part of what's going on now as well with COVID?
So I think that, what you're speaking about is implicit bias in healthcare. And I think that you cannot talk about that without talking about the other racial issues that have occurred in this country. So when we think about implicit bias in healthcare, you are correct. There have been books that have been published, studies that have been published that have shown or that have stated that as African Americans experience less pain, or they over exaggerate their symptoms, and we don't really have any evidence that that is true. And so when you think about that, you think about in the race relations in this country, where they really depicted Black folks as being animalistic or having superhuman strength. And in that way, it diminishes our ability or our perceived ability to experience pain. And so that's something that should not happen. And so there are other implicit biases in healthcare. And so when we think about that, we think that, well, if the patients are able to articulate themselves well, or if they're educated, then they may not have those issues. But that's not true, because there were reports, like Serena Williams had a blood clot in her lungs, and she went to the hospital for care, and her symptoms were downplayed as well when she had a life-threatening condition. So, it certainly happens. I think one of the ways that we can look into trying to combat that is that we identify it. A lot of people now are really looking into doing implicit bias training for healthcare providers to help them to identify those things and say, this is not how things should be. And so that's really the first step. I think that also it's been shown that Black people have a better patient care experience when their provider looks like them, because they're able to communicate and relate to them a bit better. So that's also one thing that I think is important. And so we continue to work on trying to get more minority medical students in place, residents and physicians. We are small in number, but I think that we can have a very huge impact on our communities.
The only problem I tend to have with people speaking about implicit bias training amongst physicians is that it seems like you're late to the game. Once people are already, they already have a medical degree, they're set in their ways mentally, it seems like that's a little late to do implicit bias training, maybe a refresher course, but we probably should be doing this in high school. We should probably be doing this in college or in medical school. Like maybe that's something that should be going on throughout our educational process rather than waiting until we're 30 plus years old to teach us that actually you automatically assume that this sickle cell patient, their pain isn't as bad as they say it is, you know, like that may be a little late. So it's doing something, but it may be only doing as much as singing the Black National Anthem at a baseball game.
And I will say too, because based on my experience, and I know it was a new thing that was coming along when I was going through my medical school training. Now I feel like that cultural piece and how we take care of patients is starting, or at least then was starting to slowly be implemented into the medical school curriculum. And I'm sure at this point, since that was a few years ago, that more and more schools are starting to build that in as not just an elective, but an actual part of the curriculum. And I think it really does play into the way doctors are taught, budding doctors are taught how to take care of patients and how to look at patients, because a lot of times we learn based on patient scripts and which are really just these short blurbs on patient, this type of patient comes in with this thing, what's going on. But when you step back and get the cultural context and, these other things that may, depending on what cultural upbringing you had that you may not have had exposure to, that opens your eyes on how you can better take care of patients of color or patients that aren't in different culture groups than you were brought up in.
I will say representation really does matter in everything, honestly. To see, yourself and others who are working with you or taking care of you or things like that is very important in my opinion. So, to what you were saying, Dr. Latanya, having more, Black doctors, more doctors that look like us, it's really important. So with what we know about, implicit bias in the way that, Black people are being, treated or have lack of treatment, what are some of the things that we can do, to protect ourselves in this instance where we feel like, hey, I'm not getting the type of service that I should be getting?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. So the first thing that I would recommend is number one, make sure that you are able to adequately relay your symptoms, like the symptoms that you are having for a particular condition. Be able to do that if you seek medical care, if you go to a hospital or a clinic, be able to do that within the first 5 minutes. Because a lot of times the amount of time that doctor has to spend time with you is very limited. So it's important that you hit those key things. If you have to make notes and take them in so that you are able to be focused, I can't tell you how many times I had gone in to see a patient and I asked them about this symptom and they start telling me their life story. And so it's kind of difficult to be able to narrow it down and come up with a diagnosis and be able to help someone when they aren't able to do that effectively. So that's the first thing. The second thing is be persistent. Medicine is a service. And I am one that has been saying this for many years. So if I go to a beautician and I don't like the way they do my hair, then I don't go back to that person. I go somewhere else. And so the same thing with healthcare. I mean, it's not always that simple. Sometimes you have restrictions based on your health insurance, or sometimes you have a critical condition that you need to get taken care of right away. But if there's an opportunity for you to go to a different provider, then certainly do that, because it's important that you feel comfortable with your healthcare provider. Number three, make sure you listen. For the most part, well, I can't say for the most part, I'll say that I personally, and I know that Dr. Kim and Dr. Jasmine take time with their patients and they explain what's going on and explain it to them in a way that they can understand. My goal with explaining something to a patient is, so I want to be able to explain it to you so that you can take this information and you can go to explain to somebody else. And they know exactly what's going on. So those things are all very important. And that's what I would say the top things are.
Also, one other thing I would say, if you aren't able if you don't feel comfortable enough to be able to voice your concerns, voice your complaints, or adequately state them, bring along a family member or someone else that can help advocate for you. Because a lot of times what's really important is that you have that extra person there to advocate that can help get you access to other things, other types of care that you may not have had adequate access to. For example, you know, if you can't really explain your symptoms, but you have a family member that's been seeing you deal with these symptoms, bring them along because they can say, hey, you know, they haven't been feeling well, but this and this has been going on. And between between you, your family member or caregiver or friend or whoever, and your provider, you can work together as a group to figure out like what's going on and how they can deliver the best care for you. So it's not just a single player sport, it's a team effort. And we have to use all resources that we can to provide the best care for our patients.
Yeah, and that's a really good point that Jasmine makes. I think that now during the time of COVID, it's a lot more difficult to do that, but it's important that you do that in any way that you can. So a lot of hospitals and clinics don't allow an additional person to come in just in attempts to decrease the transmission of the virus. So, I mean, whatever you have to do, if you go into your clinic appointment or if you're going into the hospital, you know, make sure you have a cell phone with you so you can call someone, so you can FaceTime them, anything so that you can be involved in the care team. That's really important. One of the things that I will say now is if you have family members, make sure you know what's going on with them. I will say for everyone, really at this point, put your health conditions, your medications, all of these types of things, put them in your cell phone to make sure you have them with you. For elderly patients who may not have a cell phone, have them on a list and make sure you take those things. Make sure you have important contacts, telephone numbers. And I know a lot of people are guilty of not answering unknown numbers at this time. But that is not a good thing right now during the time of COVID. I cannot tell you how many patients I have seen within the past 3 months in the hospital that for days and days we have been unable to contact family members because they may have a number that's on their chart. We call that number, it's no answer. And, you know, during this time of COVID, patients are getting really sick and they can die in a matter of, you know, 24 hours, sometimes less. And it's important that we're able to contact family members. So please keep that in mind. I think that's one of the things that is really important.
And I would just add, I guess just piggybacking that, definitely be persistent. I mean, that is huge. It's just like, you know, the saying goes that the squeaky wheel gets the oil. Like, you want to be a squeaky wheel in this environment because we do interact with a lot of patients. And we do have to deal with a lot of stuff, you know, as physicians. And so being that squeaky wheel, we're gonna notice, we're gonna pay a little bit closer attention, that sort of thing. And that's to your benefit and it's to your family members' benefit. And I would just say, just, you know, as a mild amount of transparency here, we recently lost our dad about 7 or 8 months ago. And so we went 10 months through this process of dealing with the healthcare community from the other side. And we had some trash experiences, like trash. But at the same time, we were persistent and we were an extremely squeaky wheel. Like, we needed some WD-40, like right now, in order to make sure that he got the best care that he possibly could get. Now, I understand, obviously, we got the medical knowledge to know what he needed, but just being being loud enough to say, you're not listening, I need you to listen, be direct when you interact with the healthcare community, whether that be the nurses, the therapists, the doctors, whoever, in order for your complaints to be heard. So it seems like a lot that you have to go through in order to just get appropriate care, but understand that we're dealing with a lot of patients. And so those sorts of things are necessary in order to have to make sure that this machine actually works.
So Dr. Tanya, we had a question for you. You was talking about high blood pressure and you know, some of the things that Black people deal with, you know. We had a question from Tammy Boyd, and she wanted to know, do you think that there may be genetic differences why African Americans have the highest mortality rates across the country versus others?
So specifically speaking to COVID-19, I mean, you know, again, I think it certainly has a lot to do with the chronic conditions. But then I think it's a combination of things. Like, I don't think it's necessarily that Black folks have more hypertension, high blood pressure, diabetes, heart disease than other people. I don't think it's necessarily only the implicit bias in healthcare. I don't think it's necessarily only that, you know, the socioeconomic things. I think it's a combination of those things. I mean, Kim or Jasmine, you guys can kind of chime in and tell your thoughts, but I feel like it's a combination of things that is causing us to see those increased numbers of death in African-American community.
Yeah, I think
it's definitely, I mean, it's certainly multifactorial. I mean, you, like you said, yes, there are comorbidities. We do have hypertension. We do have obesity. We do have diabetes, but so do other communities, right? So it's not like you don't see white people with obesity. Like, it is, you know, it's there as well. So the question is, why then, why if you separate out only obese patients, why do Black patients still die more? So that's your next question. You can separate out every individual thing that you can call a risk factor, and our mortality or the rate in which we die is still higher. And so, you know, you even add in their socioeconomic status, and a low socioeconomic, meaning a low income level, you know, that sort of thing. Low socioeconomic status is an independent risk factor for all mortality, meaning that it doesn't matter what you die from. If you're poor, you're going to die more often from it. You know, so it's those sorts of things. Everything put together is the reason why this is going on. And there is quite a bit of distrust in the medical community amongst African Americans. We have such a long history of bias and racism in every facet of our community that it has continued on to us not really trusting the medical community. When we go in to the ER, we're not really sure if you're doing the best thing for us. And so that makes us seek medical attention less. And that all compounds these things. So it's multiple things. It's not just, and is there a genetic reason? Absolutely not. You know, like, we're not a genetically inferior race or anything like that. You know, like, we all got DNA, you know? So, I mean, the sequence is just different, you know? But, so none of that really is, there's nothing on a basic level that makes us more susceptible to this virus. It's all of a societal issue that causes that, I think.
And then also to piggyback and kind of bring it full circle, I think that also I guess brings to light the fact that we need more physicians, nurses, medical providers of color to take care of patients that look like us. Because to be honest, I've had multiple patients that when I come in the room and they see me and realize that I'm their doctor, they're like, oh my gosh, I'm so proud of you. Oh my gosh, you know, I'm so glad that you're here. Because, you know, even though, you know, it seems like, oh, me and my sisters are all doctors and, you know, it should be as common as, you know, anyone else. The fact is that a lot of Black people in general haven't seen a lot of doctors that look like them. And again, that may cause some distrust in some circumstances, but having that, you know, having providers that look like them is really a big deal, because they really give a lot of weight to what we have to say, as compared to some of our other counterparts.
And I can also say that I know I personally have had success with some patients who have traditionally been very non-adherent to medical treatment plans and things like that, by just taking time to sit down with them and explain it to them, you know. And I think it's important that we understand some of the way that minority patients relay information. You know, I'll give one example. There was a patient that came in and said, you know, they were having abdominal pain. And the patient said, you know, I've been having pain for a minute. And, you know, my counterpart, who didn't look like me, was like, well, they just said that they've been having pain for a minute. I was like, oh, that means a long time. Like, a minute, that's a long time. And so right. Then I'm able to say, okay, so when you say a minute, what you mean? Is it like, you know, an hour, 3 days, a year? Help me understand what a minute means to you, you know? And so that's important when we talk about these types of things in medicine, to be able to understand, you know, what the patients are really trying to relate to us.
To what you said, Dr. Jasmine, about, you know, patients telling you they're proud of you. Hell, I'm proud of y'all. I don't personally know y'all, but, you know, just sit here talking to y'all, you know, I mean, my heart is full of pride, you know, just seeing this and hearing y'all. And, you know, hell, it's an honor, a pleasure, and a privilege for me to be sitting here, you know, talking to y'all. So I completely understand where they're coming from. I kind of wanted to transition a little bit. You know, when we talk about, you know, different things, that we kind of like to include children, you know, in our conversations. And with it being, you know, two, 3 weeks maybe, school's supposed to start nationwide. We had someone who's watching, and he wanted to know. Let me see if I can find it real quick. Gosh, I had it highlighted. Well, I can't find it. But his question pretty much was, as a medical doctor, what's your opinion on children going back to school right now?
We have these kind of discussions about these kind of controversial topics frequently between me and my sisters. That's a hard question. You know, we know that people congregating in large gatherings makes everyone in that gathering at a higher risk for transmitting, for catching as well as transmitting the coronavirus. But you know, there's also this pull that parents want to give their children the best education that they can, but in a safe way. And you know, there are plans in different communities and different school systems that have plans in place to try to make, you know, going back to school more socially distant and try to decrease the risk of transmitting coronavirus. It's not going to look like what school looked like, you know, 6-8 months ago. But personally, if I had a child, I would be concerned about sending my child to school under the same circumstances that schooling was had, you know, just 6-8 months ago based on that, you know, you're housing, you know, hundreds, maybe thousands of students in a building at one time that are congregating and playing with each other, going, like, talking, laughing, you know, in gym, doing these different things that we know are transmitting more virus particles. And, you know, that just puts everybody at a higher risk. So, I mean, it's a hard question, but, you know, it ends up being more of a, almost an individual one for each household and making the decision on how they want, like, what risks they're, you know, comfortable with taking and what changes their school system is making to try to accommodate the higher risk of the coronavirus being in that community.
I think Jasmine did an excellent job answering that question. I have nothing to add.
I think Jasmine's response was, you played that well. I'm gonna get on the other side. So I think that if we're arguing that we can't congregate in groups greater than 10, but then we're trying to send kids back to school in an environment where they're in a classroom with 25 to 30, I don't think that makes sense. And so if schools reopen, nothing should be closed, right? But we know that's not right. We know that it's right that other things stay closed. We know it's right that the movie theaters stay closed. We know it's right to not have people in basketball arenas and football arenas right now. We know that's right. But for some reason, we seem to think that we can put these kids at risk because of the misconception that was started from the beginning, same misconception like that Black people can't get coronavirus, that kids were relatively spared from this, which is also not true. We've lost over 200 children in this nation already from this coronavirus. So the fact that children have died is enough. The fact that one dies is enough for me to think that these kids shouldn't go back to school. Now, so I think the question is easy, you know, should they go back to school? The answer is no, until we get this under control. But the implementation of it is the difficult part, because there is the problem with what do parents do? Because if you have a 7-year-old, you know, and a 6-year-old and a 3-year-old, and you gotta go back to work because your company has gone back, then something has to happen with your kids. And the answer has always been school. And so that's the difficult part, is implementing keeping those kids at home when the businesses are reopening and the company offices are reopening and you're having to go back to work 3 days out of the week or all week or whatever that is. So that's the difficult part about it. The question is easy though. If we can't go back to church, if we can't go back to basketball arenas, you know, if we can't go back to these environments, like Jasmine said, there's thousands of students in these schools. It's not just your classroom of 25 even. You know, I know my high school was 4,000 or something like that people in the school. So you can't not equate that to larger settings. So I'll be the one to make the controversial statement on Facebook Live, okay? Jasmine, you did a good job, but I'll be the controversial one. There you go.
And then, so I'll piggyback on what Kim said. I think that, you know, also like from the beginning, again, this virus is relatively new. So there's a lot of things that we don't know. So we know that children can have coronavirus infection. We know that children can die. We know that the percentages are less than what we see in older patients, but there's still risk there. And then when you get into those situations where you have children at school that may be carriers of the virus and they may be asymptomatic, well, what about the teachers? What about the administrators? You know, they are usually in high-risk groups. And so then you put them at increased risk. And then what if these young people who are going to school live with elderly grandparents or things like that, then they're at increased risk as well because they're leaving school and they're going back into the home. And I think it's very unrealistic to have these children in a setting where you are going where they're having to be in a classroom setting all day, having friends, and we don't expect them to interact with them, particularly, you know, elementary age kids, preschoolers, things like that. I mean, I see my friends now and I'm excited because I haven't seen them in a while. So do I want to hug them? Yes. So we can't expect for kids to not want to do those same things. And they always share everything, including germs. So we can't expect for that not to happen when kids do go back to school. And so I think that it's important that we look at that. You know, there are going to have to be a lot of things that will have to be done. You know, distance learning is going to become a very prominent thing in our communities. I have to, since we were also talking about social determinants of health, you know, I think we also have to talk about people who may not have Wi-Fi or internet or computers and things like that in their homes. You know, that when we start to think about No Child Left Behind on the school system, you know, we know that there probably will be some children that will be left behind because they don't have those things. And so I think that, you know, in some instances, that is the push that we want to get children who don't have the opportunity to have those types of things in their home, the ability to continue their education. But it's a very difficult decision. I'm glad I don't have to make that decision to decide about kids coming, going back to school in the fall. I know a lot of school systems have chosen to delay their start. Some schools have said they're going to only do virtual learning for the first semester. I think that's a wise decision because I think that we really need to see the number of cases and deaths decrease before we can say it's safe for anyone to go back into the into a classroom setting.
And you have to realize the perspective we're coming from, right? Like as healthcare providers, our entire training has been to preserve life, right? To decrease risk of death. That's everything we're taught to do. And so when everyone's, you know, bashing Dr. Fauci and all of these, this is what we're trained to do, is try to keep you and others alive. So every element of our caution, of our warnings, all those things are to ensure that whatever risk is out there, we're trying to decrease that risk of you or whoever else developing some disease that could lead to an illness or a death. And so that's the perspective we're coming from. We're not looking at the money. We're not looking at how difficult it's going to be to implement this. We're not looking at any of that. We don't practice medicine that way. We don't ask how expensive a test is, if it's going to help you. We do it. So that's the way we practice. That's the way we're taught to practice. So I think when you look at other people in other fields, they don't always look at things like this. And so when you've had some prominent politicians say, well, you know, I'd gladly die for, you know, to keep our economy going. Well, that doesn't even compute in the mind of a physician, right? Like, you gladly, the whole reason why we're here is to minimize death and illness. Like, you know, you don't have to do that, you know? So you don't have to die. No one has to die, you know? At least of things that are preventable. So that's the way we look at this. So if you hear us saying things that seem so simple, we're not looking at the implementation of it at all. We're looking at what's the best thing to decrease transmission? What's the best thing to decrease death? That's where our specialty is. That's where our focus is. The implementation is someone else's lane. We're staying in our lane, and our lane is healthcare, and someone else's lane is finance, and we let them do that, you know? So that's one thing I want to add to that, because it may sound a lot of people may have questions. Well, how do you do that? Well, that's, you know, how do you make school not happen this fall? Well, see, that's not my lane. My lane is, what is the scientific answer here? And that's the scientific answer.
Well, I will kind of dabble in two lanes, because I am a physician, but then also I have a business degree as well. And so I think that, however, I will say that I am a doctor first. And so I'm always going to choose the option that will minimize the lives lost. And so that is why we have this particular opinion on reopening schools and reopening various businesses and entities. You know, our goals are for you to be safe. And, you know, honestly, coronavirus deaths, I mean, we know that they are going to happen, but they are largely preventable. If you stay in your home, if you practice the social distancing, if you wear a mask, if you wash your hands, then less people will die. And so that is, you know, what our resounding message is to the masses.
So you said something earlier, Dr. Tanya, that and it was something that I had every intention of trying to start off with, but you mentioned the term asymptomatic, and a lot of people don't really, you know what that is or understand, you know, what that is. Can you quickly kind of explain to them what symptomatic versus asymptomatic is?
Yeah. So, you know, initially when we heard about this coronavirus infection, one of the things that we were, that was in the media was the symptoms. So fever, cough, shortness of breath, those types of things. So as time progressed, we started to hear more about more symptoms. So loss of taste and smell. Some people can have diarrhea or vomiting. You can just have generalized weakness, those types of things. So those are all considered symptoms. Also headaches. A lot of people with COVID-19 report headaches. So asymptomatic means you don't have any of those symptoms at all, but you get a test and the test comes back positive. And so that's what we mean by asymptomatic, mean that you can feel completely fine. And if you say they do mass testing in your workplace or in a school or something like that, then your test can come back positive. So you, in fact, have enough viral particles transmitting, circulating in your body that it's enough for the test to be able to detect. So that means that you are able to transmit that infection to someone else as well. So that's what we mean by asymptomatic. And then when you asked me that question, and as I was speaking, I also start to think about the test. So there are a lot of places you should check your state or county health department website to see about where the testing is available. If you have any symptoms, you should definitely be tested. If you've been exposed to someone who has COVID-19, then you should be tested. Or if you have any concerns, then, you know, you should certainly be tested. I will make one caveat and say that the test that we have for COVID-19 is not the best test. And so in saying that, I mean that the test is not very sensitive, not as sensitive as we would like for it to be. And what sensitivity means is that, so if I have 10 patients in front of me, and I know for a fact that these patients have COVID-19, the COVID test is only going to say that 7 of those people actually have COVID-19, even though all 10 have it. So that means it's the test is 70% sensitive. So that means it has a 30% false negative rate. So when you think about it, some people get a negative test and they think that that means that they don't have COVID. Well, in many instances, that is true that they don't have COVID, but they can also have COVID. And so that's why you have been hearing a lot in the media where they say that if you have any symptoms, even if your test is negative, it is still important that you quarantine for the 14 days, because it could be that you have a false negative test and that you, in fact, do have COVID-19. So that's one of the things that I will say. And, you know, we have heard and seen lots of things going on where people get tested for COVID and then they keep going out and about. They don't restrict their movements, and then they may go out not wearing a mask, where you're putting other people at risk. So that's one of the things that I certainly wanted to speak on this evening.
So Dr. Kimberly, earlier you said a couple of things that caught my attention, and I've been holding it in my head to ask you about. One word you mentioned, mistrust, distrust, that, you know, Black people have with the medical community. And I mean, we, you know, looking back on the history of this country, we've seen the history between Black folks and how this country has regarded our health and at times used us as unwilling research subjects. We've seen it from J. Marion Sims, the father of modern gynecology, and how he used Black female slaves for his work without anesthesia. We've seen how they did Henrietta Lack and how she was done and Sarah Bartman and how they displayed, her after death and things like that. And of course, the most infamous situation, the 40-year testing of the Tuskegee experiment. And thinking about that and hearing you say mistrust, it made me think about an article that I read that said that COVID-19 vaccine would only work if trials include Black participants. And, we have such trepidation, with the medical field because of these things. I don't know how I feel about that. I do agree with that. But what's your take on that as far as Black people being a part, of these trials to get this vaccine?
Yeah, I think that's a tough one, right? Because from all the history that you described a few minutes ago, just explaining all the things that have been done wrong, it does create, like I said, this distrust amongst our community in any kind of scientific, any kind of research environment. We deal with this across all types of research. It's not just a vaccine creation. It's also in cancer treatment. It's difficult for us to get African-American patients to agree to be on cancer trials because of this. And so will we be able to develop a vaccine? Or not we, I don't create vaccines. I cut people for a living. But will the scientists be able to create a vaccine without a high level of African-American participation in research? Yes, they will be able to do it. Will there possibly be things that we don't know can happen when given to African-American patients because of that? That's also a possibility. So it's balancing those two things. The fact that the purpose of the vaccine trial isn't just to make sure that the vaccine works. So that's not the reason why we do, the primary reason or the only reason why we do vaccine trials. It's not just to make sure that if we give you this vaccine and then expose you to the virus, you won't get the virus, right? Also, the other element of vaccine trials is that we're giving you this vaccine to make sure that you don't have a reaction to it, or to find out what reactions may occur. And so that's, I think, more so where African-American participation in vaccine trials can be helpful. But it's an individual choice. If you don't trust the medical community, do not sign up for the trial. I don't care how much money they're offering you. Don't do it if you don't trust that you're going to be okay and that they're going to take care of you if anything happens. Because that vaccine will still be made, whether you are involved or not. But if you are interested in participating and the opportunity is there, then certainly take it if you'd like to participate. But that distrust is real. It has real basis, and we can't ignore it. But we deal with it across all types of research trials. So it's not just in vaccine trials. It's in everything. And we still come out with new chemos, and we still come out with new treatments, with or without it. So, and you can still benefit from them, whether you participate in the trial or not. And so this was something that America created over 100 years, and this is the outcome of it. So the fact that we should be expected to jump right in and trust now, I think it's a little misguided in itself.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. It's hard, to subject yourself to that, especially when, knowing the history, of this country, and not only the history, but, the present state that we're in. And, we kind of talked about it earlier about how patients are treated now and how they, you know, view our pain tolerance and things like that. Like one of the things that I thought about, you know, listening to y'all when we was talking about disproportionate deaths, and this is a whole separate, you know, topic and one that I'm pretty sure we could talk about, you know, hours on end, but Black women dying at a rate of 3 to 4 times of white women in childbirth and, you know, childbirth complications. Dr. Latonya, you kind of brought it up earlier with Serena, and I think it's, what is it called, preeclampsia, or something like that.
Preeclampsia.
Okay. So, you know, it made me think about that, and it made me wonder, like, you know, why, you know, are Black women at such a high risk, and, like, you know, what can they do to protect themselves, you know, in that situation?
So the first thing I will say is that between me, Kim, and Jasmine, we are not OBGYN. So we don't, none of us take care of pregnant patients. So we'll start there. So we'll have to bring someone else in to this discussion to really answer that question effectively. But I think, again, kind of going back to what I said before, you know, have a bit of knowledge about, you know, what your numbers should look like. And if they are not in that realm, then to make sure you seek out medical attention for that and to seek treatment for those numbers. What I do know about preeclampsia is that it certainly does increase the risk of both infant and maternal mortality. So it's important that those are treated. For women who have high blood pressure going into pregnancy, then they're also at an increased risk for developing preeclampsia. So that means that it's even more important that you have those things checked throughout pregnancy. I would say, you know, make sure that if you fit into that category, then make sure you're checking your blood pressure on a regular basis and keeping a logbook. I think that that's very important as well, to be able to take to your doctor and say, look, you know, yeah, my blood pressure has been high going throughout. So, you know, and you may have to take medications or do some type of dietary modification to be able to address that. But that's about the extent of my knowledge of taking care of pregnant women.
So a lot of these patients end up seeing specialists within the OBGYN community that deal with patients that are at higher risk of these kind of complications. But the biggest thing is developing that relationship with your provider, so that you're actually being seen regularly and checked regularly, so that even if it is early on in your pregnancy, that you know, your medical provider can catch these things early and try to stay on top of them, because that way, you know, if these things do develop seemingly out of the blue, there's somebody with eyes on you already.
Well, I really do hope we can find someone who could, you know, who's an expert in that field, we can, you know, talk to and kind of, you know, bring that to the forefront. But I do thank you all for, you know, chiming in for the information that you did give. I do appreciate that. So we've talked about symptoms and being asymptomatic. We've talked about testing. We've talked about, you know, vaccine, you know, coming, not even, you know, a year or whatever it is. To kind of bring everything full circle and kind of, you know, close it out. People are hard-headed and still want to do, you know, what they want to do. And I know numbers are going up and things of that nature. But as of right now, do you think it's safe to do like some of the summertime activities with our children right now, or should we just stay in the house and just be done with it all?
So I think that, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jasmine.
Some activities are safe to do. I mean, if these, you know, activities like going to parks or, you know, playing, like for kids playing outside at their homes, are things that that you don't necessarily come in contact with large gatherings of other people. Households, those are safer activities. I think your risk definitely increases when you go, when you think about traveling to new places or, you know, going to amusement parks or, you know, resorts or things like that where you can come into large gatherings of people, your risk of transmitting the virus becomes higher. But, you know, that's why, unfortunately, where I was becoming more creative about how to, you know, one, stay active and two, you know, make the best out of the summer that kind of is going to be remembered for being different from all the rest. So, you know, those are, I think, activities within those from your household are probably safer. But when you start branching out to including other families and other, you know, groups of people that you don't live with, that's when you get into risk that you don't, that can't really be quantified.
But Jazz, what I think Tyra's trying to ask is, he was planning to take his kids to Disney World next week. He's trying to find out whether or not he should take them.
The answer is no, don't do it.
Yeah,
so. actually it was Universal Studios, but yeah, you was right.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that statement from Jasmine and with Kim. I think that, you know, there are some things that you can control. You know, you can control what is going on in your household. You know that you have been remaining safe. You haven't been going out to clubs or bars, and you haven't been hanging out, you know, without a mask with large groups of people. So your family group is probably okay. When you start branching out with other people, particularly people that you don't know what they have been doing, then that increases your family's risk when you go into these group settings. And that is anything from, you know, going to a cookout, which we don't recommend, particularly because cookouts usually have shared utensils. You're usually eating food buffet style, that is increased risk for transmitting a virus. You know, pool parties, things like that. We don't typically recommend those things if they're outside of people who live in the home with you. So all of those things really put you at increased risk for catching the virus. And so that's why we say those things. You know, I think that, so COVID is something that we can't see. You know, we can't necessarily look at somebody and be like, oh, they got the Rona. You know, we don't know. So I usually will, one of the ways that I've really been able to relay that information to people is, it's kind of like a STD, you know? So if you are sexually active with someone who has an STD, then they can get the STD. Then you can get the STD. And then pretty much if you're sexually active with other people, then they also can get that STD. And so that's kind of how it spreads. Like, people don't look sick, but then you get to a point where, okay, it started off with one person having the disease, and then you got 50 people that have the disease. And so you have to view everyone when you're outside of your home, think of that everybody that you come into contact with has COVID, because that is a possibility. And so what can you do to protect yourself? And so that's really how you have to approach the world. And it's a very different way to look at things, but that's kind of the life that we are living at this time.
Oh yeah, everybody scared me hell. Like, you know, I go to the store and I got on a mask, and you know, I stay 6-8 feet away from people, and if somebody's walking on the same side as me, I'll turn around and walk all the way around if I have to. You know, it's necessary that I go, but I also have kids I need to protect. So I'm scared of everybody right now. I mean, we could go on and on about this. It's so much to cover, but I know, you know, you all have lives and are busy, and, you know, it's getting late where you are. And, you know, as I told you, before we started, I really do appreciate each one of you, you know, stopping by and talking with us and teaching us and, you know, blessing us with your years of experience and knowledge. And I really do appreciate it. Thank you. So before we get out of here, if you want each one of you to just drop a final thought or words of wisdom for everybody's watching to, you know, help them along in this crazy time?
I'll start, I guess. Just because something that obviously I think hasn't really been focused on much yet, but I guess thinking forward, thinking closer to the next 10 years, 20 years after COVID, I think it's really, 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 really important for you to vote. And that's something that we're not really talking about in relation to COVID. It's not just because of your feelings or my feelings about how this administration has completely flubbered this response, but more so it's because what's done is done. Like what happened in March happened in March. What happened in February happened in February. But looking forward, one thing that this administration has been going hard after and continues to is the Affordable Care Act. One element of that Affordable Care Act that's very important is the clause related to pre-existing conditions. What that means is that right now, insurance companies cannot deny coverage and they can't increase the cost of your coverage because you have a disease already before you got the insurance. And so they have to insure you at a regular level at this point because you know, if you have diabetes or if you have heart problems or something like that before you got that job and got that insurance or something like that. That came along with the Affordable Care Act, and it's huge. It's especially going to be huge now because now you have, what was the number, Tanya? 3.5 million?
Yeah, it's like 3.5 million people.
Yeah, so it's like 3.5 million people who have tested positive. So that's not how many people actually have it. It's probably closer to 6 who actually have it because you got to remember that all those people live with people who may not have gotten tested. And most of the people they live with probably got it from them, right? So we're looking at tens of millions of people, if not hundreds of millions of people at the end of this who will have had COVID. What we are seeing with COVID infections, as you all know, is people come in with difficulty breathing. Those people tend to have changes on their chest x-ray. Like you can tell that something is going on there. Usually with any other virus that causes issues with breathing, those changes will go away over a few months. We're not seeing that happen with these people. So they're getting x-rays 4 months later and they still have those changes. What we don't know is how long they're going to have problems. And so if you get COVID and you have heart problems because of COVID, we're seeing that people have heart failure because of COVID infections. We see, and these are young people, these aren't 60, 80 year olds, these are 30, 40 year olds. We're seeing these same relatively young people have issues breathing afterwards. Marathon runners who can't run a block months after their COVID infection. And so if, let's say you didn't have that bad of a COVID infection, but you had some shortness of breath, you went in and got an x-ray, it shows some changes. 6 months later, those changes are still there. You get a new job 5 years from now and you need an inhaler, then your insurance company may not cover it if they get rid of that pre-existing conditions clause, because that was a pre-existing condition. You had COVID and you developed that way back in 2020. It's 2026 now, and you had an asthma attack and your insurance company won't cover it. So that's the reason why it's so important to vote, is to make sure that you got people in there who are gonna protect the things that matter to you. And one of the major things that should matter to everyone listening to this and everyone else is their health. Without it, you have nothing. So please, please, please register to vote. There's still time in every state. There's not one state where the November elections at this point are off the table for you. So register to vote, show up on the day of, and definitely vote in order to protect that particular thing in light of this COVID pandemic.
I'll just echo what Kim said. I mean, definitely vote. It's so important right now. And then in talking about the pre-existing condition clause, you know, we also heard a lot previously about this antibody testing that was available for COVID. We really don't know what that means. So there's no real proof at this point that if you've had COVID-19 that you can't get it again. There have actually been some early reports that have shown that patients who have had COVID in the past can actually get another infection with COVID. But if you think about the antibody testing, so a lot of people were going to get antibody testing. And so it says, oh, you have positive antibodies to COVID. Well, that is also something that could potentially be used against you when you are attempting to get that health insurance coverage down the road if they take away the pre-existing condition. So they'll say, oh, you have COVID in the past, so we're not going to insure you for any respiratory things. Like anytime you have any respiratory illnesses, then that's not going to be covered. So that's something to consider as well. And then also just to close out, you know, make sure you stay as healthy as you can. You know, health is wealth. It's very important for you to be the captain of your health ship. You know, make sure that if you have any chronic illnesses, that you are making sure you address those things. If you have been prescribed medications for different conditions, make sure that you take those as they are prescribed, take them appropriately, follow up with your doctor at regular intervals. You know, a lot of these conditions are things that can be managed with medications and with appropriate medical care. Those are all things that are very important. And just, you know, do your best to stay safe. At this point, I'm closing out everything, every text message, every email with stay safe. And that is my closing remark.
I'll piggyback on that. Definitely, if you can, you know, create a relationship with a medical provider that you identify as your own. Because, you know, I think all my sisters can attest to this. Sometimes it's very difficult in getting new patient appointments for different patients trying to establish care with primary care providers. But as best you can, you know, identify a medical provider that's not urgent care, that's not somebody that you're seeing someone new each time you come in with a different complaint, because that relationship that you have with your provider is huge. Because even if you're not able to see them, you know, in person same day, that because, you know, everything with COVID, telemedicine visits are big. You know, basically technology is being utilized in a way that it hasn't been before in healthcare. And so just having that relationship with a provider that can put a face to a name is going to be big. Other things, you know, check on your family, check on your friends, check on those people that you know, that are closest to you. Because, you know, unfortunately, because we're all living our separate lives and are more disconnected than we have ever been, you know, just that social piece and making sure that, you know, those closest to you are, you know, maintaining their health is important. And like we say, you know, they're because, you know, of certain restrictions in different health systems and how many patients, how many visitors can come in with patients or can come see patients while they're in the hospital, because that's limited. Having those, maintaining connections with your family and relatives and friends is going to be big in one, being an advocate for their care, but also making sure that you can do everything that you can to make sure that you and your family are healthy and safe.
And then also, I just thought about one additional thing when Jasmine was talking, is the self-care piece. You know, make sure you are taking care of yourself during this time. You know, take time to unplug, take time to turn the TV off, to hop off of social media. Sometimes those things can get a bit overwhelming when you're constantly looking at the numbers going up. You're constantly seeing that there's increased death around you. I definitely agree with checking on family members. If it's somebody that you think of out of the blue, pick up the phone and call them. Even, I would say, not even always send them a text message, like pick up the phone and call them. I would say that during this, the past 3 to 4 months with COVID, I know I've talked to a lot of people that I hadn't talked to in a very long time. And, you know, I think it's been helpful. I know I have enjoyed being able to connect with them. And although not in person, just to have that personal contact has been really helpful.
Oh, man, I just want to say again, thank you all for doing this. You know, just listen to you all talk, you know, I can hear the amount of care and love and, you know, in your voices and like, I mean, you know, you can talk to people and know when they're full of shit, excuse my language, but I just don't get that with y'all. Like, I really feel like you really do care about, you know, not only yourselves, your family, but, you know, the Black community as a whole and, you know, the betterment of the Black community. And, you know, I just can't thank you guys enough for doing this. I do hope that, you know, you guys can come back, you know, again and talk about, you know, whatever you want to talk about. Dr. Tanya, you know, we've talked offline about, you know, some other things. I'm really looking forward to, you know, you doing whatever it is that you want to do. The floor is yours, as well as you, Dr. Jasmine and Dr. Kimberly. You know, Black Widow Chaser, we're here for, you know, here for you. The floor is yours. The door is open. To those of you watching, I really hope you guys learn, you know, from them as much as I did. And I hope, you know, moving forward, you know, we take heed to the advice that they gave us and really follow this in order to keep ourselves and our families safe. I don't think we're out of the woods or anywhere close. And, you know, I just sincerely hope, you know, that the second wave isn't, you know, too bad on us. So please wash your hands, practice social distancing, wear a mask, and most importantly, if you can, stay your ass at home. Any final words, ladies?
So I just have one final thing to say. I mean, we would be remiss if we didn't take the opportunity to recognize our mom who is watching on Facebook Live. So, hey, Mama.
She's actually in the comment. And she left a comment.
Yeah, she did leave a comment.
I was going to bring that up.
And so, you know, we are definitely where we are because of the love and care and support that were provided by she and my father. And so I cannot give enough thanks to her for everything that she has provided for us and that she continues to provide for us. I think that I know for me, my mom is the strongest Black woman I know. I draw a lot from her. I am a lot like her in many ways, even though I don't always want to admit, I think we all have a part of her inside of us. But just wanted to say, Mom, thank you for everything that you have done for us and that we love you.
I know. She was in the comments. That's my baby. I think that's pretty dope too. You know, like again, like just seeing how y'all interact with each other. You know, we were offline, and you know, having mom here and just y'all are just an awesome family, and I'm really happy to meet you guys, and very fortunate to talk to you and. Again, it's an honor and a pleasure.
And just one quick thing, you mentioned second wave, and I think I can speak for all of us on here. Well, we don't think we're out of the first one yet. Like, we still think this is that first wave. We don't think this is the second wave yet. So I don't think we're really going to dip down in order to really see a second wave truly, but we're definitely in our first wave right now. Just throw that out.
Well, here's the hope, and this is the first and only way, and we can, you know, slide right on through this and get back to whatever the new normal would be. On behalf of the fabulously fantastic Dr. Washington, Dr. Latanya, Dr. Jasmine, Dr. Kimberly, on behalf of myself, on behalf of Black with No Chaser. I appreciate everybody who tuned in. We appreciate the likes and shares. Please share this on all your socials. The replay will be up on our IG channel as well as on our YouTube channel. So please share this and get the word out because this is some, you know, awesome and important information that was shared with us. Again, thank you, Dr. Washington's for doing this, and I look forward to doing this again.
Thank you.
Thanks.